Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. From the AIDS pandemic to the Mayan calendar, from global warming to the Fukushima meltdown, our culture has become obsessed with the end of the world, the end of civilization, the end period. Where does this fixation come from? And what are the consequences of this mindset for our future? The writer Matthew Barrett Gross and his co-author Mel Gillis explore these questions and more in a new book. And Matthew Barrett Gross joins me now in studio. And Matthew, great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Matthew Barrett Gross will read from The Last Myth, What the Rise of Apocalyptic Thinking Tells Us About America, at a book signing this Friday at the King's English Bookshop here in Salt Lake City. More details on that as we go. Matthew Barrett Gross rewrote the rules of presidential politics as director of internet communications for Howard Dean's 2004 presidential campaign. He's a major new media strategist. He's the editor of the Glen Canyon Reader, the media director for SUA, and co-author of this new book, The Last Myth. We'll be talking with him about this book and more. Later on in the program, though, we're turning our attention to going vegan and why many Utahns are embracing a vegan diet. But first, end times thinking. What do you think about the Mayan calendar prediction or predictions of a meteor striking Earth and changing life as we know it? If you have questions or comments about the apocalyptic era, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Matthew Barrett Gross, you've got such a range of experience. You've been involved in new media, in politics, in strategy. Why did you turn your attention to writing about the end of the world?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I began working on this book with my wife, Mel, way back in 2004, 2005, you know, which, as you'll recall, was when George Bush was reelected, and there was a great deal of talk about the power of evangelical Christians in reelecting George W. Bush and the important role that they played in reelecting him. And at the same time, so we heard from the left this kind of derision of that worldview and the effect it was having on politics. But at the same time, we were seeing on the left a rise in concern about global warming and Al Gore's book, An Inconvenient Truth, which, you know, we observed and felt, you know, also kind of relied upon this apocalyptic narrative to make a case and make a point. And we just began to see it more and more within the media and within the cultural discussion about what was going on in the world. And so it became fascinating to us, and we started to ask, now, why are we speaking this way? Why are so many issues being plugged into this apocalyptic narrative?
You call apocalyptic thinking an addiction, and in the book you compare it to a virus. Elaborate on that, if you would.
Well, what we're kind of pursuing, you know, as we wrote the book, the question becomes, how did we begin to think this way? And very often when we talk about the apocalypse, we like to dismiss it and say, well, people have always thought this way. Well, of course, there's a very long history to apocalyptic thinking going back more than 2,500 years, but we also see it kind of accelerating, particularly with the arrival of the atomic age, and we argue over the past several decades through Y2K, and now here we are at approaching 2012 and December 21st in the Mayan apocalypse, or the so-called Mayan apocalypse. And so what we find is, you know, this is something that has evolved and changed over time. It's interesting that very often when we think of the apocalypse, we think of it as a static idea, as something that's been always been with us. But of course, no ideas are static. Ideas change over time, and sometimes they grow in power, and sometimes they recede from the mainstream.
Is it inextricably linked to religion? You note that while faith traditions have certainly embraced apocalyptic thinking, they're not the only ones.
No, they're not. And in fact, I mean, obviously, you know, the expectation of the apocalypse is central to Christian theology, and the return of Christ is central to that, to Christianity. But that idea has profoundly influenced, you know, the secular worldview and the Western worldview. It's been a constant companion to the Western worldview for 2,500 years. And so what we find interesting is this sort of dismissal of apocalyptic thinking among more secular thinkers without an examination of how is that way of thinking about history and the end of history, how has that sort of been carried forward by the secular idea of progress?
Mm-hmm. You note in the book that this idea is an overriding theme in our times right now. You sort of compare it to like how we think of the 60s as the hippie era,
right,
and how we think of, greed dominating the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
So what is apocalyptic thinking, what does that say about us as a culture today?
Well, I think it may say that we're very insecure about the future for a variety of reasons, and we've been faced with a number of unprecedented events, in the past 10 years, from 9/11, of course, to Hurricane Katrina, and we see this sort of anxiety about the future reflected back to us in our popular culture. These days, of course, the apocalypse is used to sell Chevy trucks during the Super Bowl, and it's the basis of hit pop singles. And this summer, it's going to be the basis of a romantic comedy. And of course, on cable television, we see it increasingly. I mean, the History Channel has an entire Armageddon week that they broadcast every year, right? And one of the hot new shows in reality TV now is Doomsday Preppers on National Geographic. So we're fascinated by this idea, and it keeps coming back to us. And what we find kind of interesting about the apocalypse and what we explore in the book is, we're uncomfortable with it. And there's a desire, I think, within us to push it off into the margins and pretend that only other people think that way. Yet at the same time, it is all around us in popular culture. And so it's fascinating. How can an idea be at once mainstream and marginal?
Hmm. We're speaking with Matthew Barrett Gross. He is the co-author of the book, The Last Myth, What the Rise of Apocalyptic Thinking Tells Us About America. He wrote it with his wife, Mel Gillis, and he will be reading from the book at a signing event at the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City this Friday night at 7, and you can find all the details on our website, kcpw.org. If you'd like to join us, we're talking about the end of the world. 801-355-TALK is the number, 801-355-8255. Matthew, in the book, you spend a lot of time sort of tracing the evolution. It didn't just, you said that we have this mentality, it's always been with us. But mm-hmm. there has been sort of incremental steps toward where we are today. Maybe you can talk about some of the apocalyptic strains that sort of ebbed and flowed through history that you noted in this book.
Yeah, well, it is interesting, and we purposefully kind of take a step back to disabuse readers of the notion that it's always been with us, because we find it kind of stunts our ability to think critically about the apocalypse and what role it might be playing in culture today. So we reach back and, to really the beginnings of human history to examine what did people think, in prehistory? What did they believe about the apocalypse? And what you find, it's a fascinating story, is this idea, the idea of the apocalypse really begins to originate, obviously, among the Jewish people, but at a time when humanity as a whole is starting to really imagine the idea of history and what is the meaning of history. And that's a question that the apocalypse is, completely tied up with and inextricably, you can't divorce it from that.
Mm-hmm.
And so you find, of course, when at the time of Christ, you have this tremendous apocalyptic expectation among the Jewish people, right? They've suffered for, hundreds of years at the hands of the Greeks, at the Babylonians before them, and now they're sort of riven by internal dissent and Roman rule. And, that's the that kind of expectation that things have to change and they have to change soon and radically is really the historic kind of milieu that Jesus Christ, appears into. And then over time, of course, we see this idea of the apocalypse kind of traced through the history of Europe, because, of course, the Roman Empire adopts the idea of Christianity. And then we see, at the time of the Reformation, we see Martin Luther, saying that Pope Leo is the Antichrist, right? And you see this kind of explosion of apocalyptic rhetoric. And then eventually you have, obviously, the Reformation. And then we kind of find that the apocalypse as an idea really becomes central when the Puritans sail across from Southampton to America to find America, found America.
So and it's, it sort of kind of pops in and pops out then.
Exactly. You know, it ebbs and flows. You know, there are times when it exerts this tremendous power on the history of the world, obviously. The Reformation is one great example. And then there are times when it sort of falls into the background again. And what we find is when it's surging into the mainstream a bit, those are kind of inflection points in history. And mm-hmm. they're very interesting. It's very interesting the way that the apocalypse as an idea is used both to promote dissent and to express anxiety.
You note that there's not always been a literal interpretation of the Book of Revelations,
mm-hmm.
That St. Augustine argued that Jesus's predictions were always meant to be allegorical rather mm-hmm. than literal.
Yeah.
And in some ways, how ironic it was that actually drew more attention to the apocalyptic prophecies of that particular book of Scripture.
Yes, absolutely. You know, then there's a number of kind of strange ironies when you look at the history of apocalypse over the past 2,000 years, you know, and some interesting tidbits in terms of how it gains strength. You know, why does it gain strength around the time of the Reformation is largely due to the rise of the Gutenberg printing press and the rise of literacy among Europeans, so that people are able to begin to interpret the apocalypse in their own way on a much larger scale, and to ignore sort of, as you say, Augustine and the Catholic Church's interpretation of the Book of Revelation as allegorical rather than literal.
We're speaking with Matthew Barrett Gross. He is a writer down in Moab. He's here in Salt Lake because he's reading from his new book, The Last Myth, at a book signing event this Friday night at 7 o'clock at the King's English Bookshop. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Let's go to the phones, and let's go to Jim in Salt Lake City. Jim, hi.
Hi. So I haven't read your book yet, but it seems to me that the more modern apocalyptic visions that incorporate science have a little bit more factual base to them, especially in a time when we're reaching peak oil, peak fresh water, peak rare minerals, and peak just about everything else. And I wondered where you come in on those that are more linked to, like, population explosion as being the underlying.
So, Jim, you don't think that this should be considered to be a myth, that there are some real measurable instances where, you know, we are headed toward destruction?
Right, and I don't know how much the ancients, you know, knew of future events, but it is rather interesting that we live in a time when all of these things are coming together at one time, and I wondered about the view of population, just that we do have models in biology where species have outgrown their resource base and have had experienced huge diebacks as a result of that, and I just wondered if these more scientifically based visions of a dire future might have a little bit more weight to them.
Jim, it's an interesting point. Thanks very much for the call. Matthew Barrett Gross, what do you say?
Well, I think he makes an excellent point. And in fact, you know, in the 250 pages of the book, about 70 pages, you know, kind of reflect back upon what ancients believed and then the Judeo-Christian history of the apocalypse. And the remainder of the book really is looking at what's going on today and examining some of those more scientific scenarios for the end of the world or the end of our present way of life. And, you know, so we look at peak oil and we look at global warming and we look at overpopulation. And one of the questions we ask in the book and we're really posing it to the reader is, while we certainly agree that science has propelled the apocalyptic imagination, and in fact, that's what we argue in the book, that in particular since the dawn of the nuclear age, and as we've learned more about science and the way the universe works and sort of the randomness of the universe that we live in, we find ourselves turning more and more to the apocalypse as an idea or as an explanatory narrative. And
but
so what
you,
we
can,
find
can
interesting...
Can you divorce it, though? Because, you know, as Jim mentioned, there is a confluence of all these different things.
There,
the peak oil, the, you know, the global warming, rising temperatures. You cannot ignore that there's all of these major things going around.
Absolutely.
How can you divorce yourself from that apocalyptic narrative and look at these things independently?
Well, you know, one of the things we sort of challenge the reader to do towards the end of the book is to imagine what would it look like to look at these sort of massive problems, these problems that appear almost mythical in scale, right? What would it be like to look at those problems without thinking apocalyptically? Might that change how we react to them? Might that change how we respond to them? Might we perhaps be more inclined to work together to reach across the aisle to find some consensus?
We're speaking with Matthew Barrett Gross. He is the author of The Last Myth, What the Rise of Apocalyptic Thinking Tells Us About America. His co-author is Mel Gillis. Gross will be reading from The Last Myth at a book signing event at the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City this Friday night at 7 o'clock. And you can find more information on our website, kcpw.org. If you'd like to join our conversation about apocalyptic thinking, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is the number, 801-355-8255. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. We're talking about what it means to live in a culture obsessed with the end times. From the popular Left Behind book series to the Mayan calendar to global pandemics, predictions and ideas about a coming apocalypse have gone mainstream. In a new book, Utah authors Matthew Barrett Gross and Mel Gillis explore the origins of end times thinking and why we're so fascinated with the end of civilization today. Matthew Barrett Gross joins me in studio, and you can join us as well. Do you buy into the idea that the end of the world is nigh? Does this conclusion come from your religious tradition, from scientific study, both? 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Matthew Barrett Gross will be reading from The Last Myth at a signing event this Friday night at 7 o'clock. We'll give you details on that as we go. You mentioned before the break the programming on the Discovery Channel the media's role in perpetuating what you call this last myth. Mm-hmm. Embellish on that, if you would.
Well, I think, you know, what you find is, of course, you know, if you trace back and look at the explosion of media really since the late 80s, but obviously through today, you see the rise of cable news, you see the rise of the internet, you know, you see, you know, multiple channels, you know, not to sound like the person who says, you know, back when I was growing up, we had to walk, you know, 3 miles in foot-deep snow uphill both ways. But, you know, of course, you know, growing up, you know, I was born in 1972, and we had 13 channels, and six of them were fuzzy, you know. And, of course, now there's hundreds and hundreds of channels on cable. And when you look at the amount of news programming that existed back in the days of the big three networks, it was about 3 hours per day, right? And now, of course, we have multiple channels with 24-hour news cycle, and that creates a vacuum of content that needs to be filled. And we argue to a certain degree it needs to be filled with increasingly sort of exciting and salacious content to draw eyeballs, because we're distracted. We can tune into our iPods, we can tune into radio, we can surf the net. And so that creates what we call kind of a great inflation in terms of attracting news. So almost any story suddenly can be told through the idea that this is going to be the end of the world as we know it.
So at any given moment, we can, if we want, we can look for this information, and it's right there for us.
Yeah, and it's really funny, and there's a certain pattern. I know my wife Mel was in Greensboro, North Carolina, doing a reading last week, and the day of the reading, you know, on the front cover of the paper was an article that was talking about the solar flares and the solar storm that was coming our way, and, you know, saying how disruptive it could be. And you read down a few paragraphs and says, well, these solar storms were actually quite common back in the 90s as well. And, you know, so there's this kind of apocalyptic lead that draws in the viewer. You know, there's an old axiom in local news that if it bleeds, it leads. But now we're at an age where if it might bleed, it still leads.
We're speaking with Matthew Barrett Gross, author of the book The Last Myth. What is the last myth?
Well, what we argue is it's really this kind of belief that some cataclysmic event is going to happen in the very near future, and it's ultimately the value of that event is it's going to prove the sort of person who either longs for or fears that event correct. It kind of proves our worldview correct. So when global warming happens, it kind of proves the environmentalist warnings about our relationship to nature, right? When hyperinflation happens, it proves the kind of gold bugs fear about, you know, and warnings about fiat currency and so on and so forth. So these sort of fears of collapse, they prove a point.
Let's go to back to the phones. 801-355-TALK is the number. Let's go to David in Salt Lake. David, are you there? Nope. It looks like he's gone. 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. So what are the byproducts of this apocalyptic thinking? You mentioned that, you know, we're fearful, we're a little insecure. What else does it say about
us? Yeah, it certainly creates fear and insecurity, but I think, you know, our reaction to apocalyptic thinking is complex. You know, sometimes we dismiss it, sometimes we embrace it, sometimes we secretly embrace it. But it also causes us to react in different ways. Sometimes we think, well, if the world's going to end, what can I do about it? I'm just going to go party and enjoy it while I can, right? And others of us maybe become obsessed with preparing, you know, and sort of as if global warming or, you know, peak oil is just going to be a winter storm. And if we have a bug out pack and some food stacked in the pantry, that it'll pass, you know, eventually it'll melt away, you know. But none of these sort of responses really cause us to come together as a society and say, well, how are we going to address these issues? How do we really address, problems of energy, problems of population growth? And of course, it also causes us, going back to the idea that we see all these different scenarios, we kind of get confused as to which ones are real, which ones are truly trends that are happening versus which are potential imaginary events like a meteor coming to strike the Earth.
Or, as you point out, Y2K. There was a lot of hype about that, you know, a lot of concern that as computers crash, our grid will completely shut down and nuclear weapons will go off. And it was kind of this sort of chain reaction of events.
Well, right. And it's sort of, and, you know, the interesting thing about Y2K is the notion that, you know, we actually did invest a lot of money to kind of rebuild our electronic infrastructure. And some people say, well, that was a waste of money. But we actually did something about it. And when you go back and think about the discovery of the hole in the ozone layer back in the mid-80s and the rather prompt kind of worldwide ban of CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons, which were causing that hole in the ozone layer, I think those are examples actually where what potentially could be catastrophic, apocalyptic threats were actually addressed. And so I think, you know, when we think about these large-scale problems and these problems that kind of reach a level of myth in our minds and in our popular imagination, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're insurmountable or unaddressable, though as they get tied up within the apocalyptic storyline, we tend to think so and we kind of start to react to the idea of the apocalypse rather than what should we do about this, you know?
That is kind of the heart of your argument, that this is a mindset, it's an attitude, mm-hmm. and that can change. And yet that's probably the hardest thing to change, isn't it?
It definitely is, and we don't offer, you know, specific prescriptions as to how to change it. But one thing that I think we ask the reader to do within the book is to examine the ways in which they might be thinking this way and the ways in which it may be preventing, you know, the sort of expectation of collapse or apocalypse, maybe preventing them from addressing either global problems or, you know, things that they want to address within their own lives. You know, ultimately, there's really nothing of value to be proven right about global warming. I mean, it won't be positive for anybody, you know, and, you know, there are far better ways to prove a point.
In the book, you offer a cautionary tale mm-hmm. of how one culture, how it just clung to a specific set of beliefs and values to its detriment. Talk about the settlement of Greenland.
Well, this is a story that comes to us from Jared Diamond's book Collapse, which was a bestseller, several years ago. And it's a story of the Norse settled Greenland around 986 and exist for several hundred years, but they really cling to this identity, this self-identity of themselves as Europeans, and they feel much closer to Europeans. And there's a bit of fortuitous or not fortuitous climatic luck for the Norse in that they happen to settle Greenland just as the Little Ice Age, which is kind of a period of cooling, begins. And so the temperatures that they encounter in Greenland when they first arrive change over the years, and the winters get longer and colder, and the agriculture and shepherding and such that they were able to practice when they first arrive, they're not able to practice as temperatures get colder. And they ultimately disappear from Greenland. But what's ironic, and, you know, again, Jared Diamond tells this story, is the Inuit people were there in Greenland and were able to survive those lengthening winters and colder climates because they were able to, eat fish, among other things. And the Norse had this cultural taboo against eating fish. You know, they probably could have survived and said they'd starved to death because they were more concerned about remaining European, and they had this sort of denigrating view of the native people in Greenland, that they didn't adopt or change their customs, and ultimately they disappeared from Greenland.
Hmm. So what does that tell you about where we are today? What lessons do you draw from that?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, there's this notion of sort of, you know, worldview defense, which is this idea that when we're faced with a threat to our mortality, we'll cling more closely to our cultural beliefs. So one of the questions and parallels that we raise in the book is there a parallel between this notion that we feel threatened and feel threatened by these large-scale problems facing us? And if we are we more likely to cling to our cultural belief? Are we more likely to cling to a belief in progress or growth or, you know, some of the things that we've experienced in the last 30 years, obviously much more than that, but, you know, in particular, this idea of a more globalized world, is that really the only way forward, or is it presenting large-scale problems for us that maybe if we rethought how we view the world, we might be able to address some of these large-scale problems? Are they ultimately problems, in other words, of a worldview?
Hmm. You worked on Howard Dean's political campaign years ago. I'm curious what you think of the political landscape today. when we talk about apocalyptic thinking,
yeah.
Are you seeing any candidates out there thinking outside the box, as you advise?
I don't. Unfortunately. It's interesting. You know, one thing that we know we'll hear from both sides, like whoever the Republican nominee is, and we know we'll hear from President Obama as he seeks re-election, is, and we hear it every election cycle, is how absolutely important this election cycle is. And there's kind of a vision that if we do make the right choice now, whatever the right choice is, that future generations will look back on us and thank us, and we'll finally be able to address these problems. And, of course, that doesn't really quite happen. But we hear the rhetoric again and again. But it will certainly be an interesting election.
Mm-hmm. So why did you write this book?
You know, again, it just goes back to an absolute curiosity of, you know, when we talk about ideas, I think most people accept that ideas change over time and that they have times when they're more in the mainstream and times when they're on the margins, you know, whether we're talking about the idea of money or the idea of equality or the idea of progress, you know, we accept that these things evolve and change and grow and recede at times. But when we talk about the apocalypse, there's kind of this impulse to say, oh, it doesn't matter. It's always been with us. Mm-hmm. And we wrote the book because, as we argue, these secular visions of apocalypse actually do have something important to tell us.
Speaking with Matthew Barrett Gross, he is the author of The Last Myth, What the Rise of Apocalyptic Thinking Tells Us About America, co-written with Mel Gillis. Gross will be reading from The Last Myth at a book signing event at the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City this Friday night at 7 o'clock. And there's more information on our website, kcpw.org. Matthew Gross, thanks very much for your time. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Up next, we're talking about veganism and going vegan. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City.